Hi, this is Alex Romanovich, and welcome to Global Edge Talk. Today is December 27th, 2023, and we have Mike Linton as our guest in our show. Hello, Mike.
Hey, Alex. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. First, I want to make an introduction and tell you about Mike Linton. Mike is well known for being a celebrity chief marketing officer. We can easily say that. Starting his CMO days with Best Buy, eBay, as a chief marketing officer there, and then continuing with a number of board seats. We're talking about probably 10 plus board seats, inclusive of companies like Pete's Coffee, and Capella Education Company, and a variety of smaller, mid-size, and earlier stage startups. He then continued his career at Farmers Insurance as an enterprise chief marketing officer, and also spent quite a bit of time with Ancestry, a well-known Ancestry platform, as a chief revenue officer. So a well-rounded career. C-suiting, as Mike says, C-suiting for over 25 years. But most importantly, Mike started a very interesting, a very, I would say, controversial podcast called the CMO Confidential, which is something that we will talk a little bit about as well. And that's all we can say right now. Mike, welcome to our studio.
Gosh, thanks for that great introduction. I'm going to play it for my parents. So I really appreciate it. Thanks.
Your mom will appreciate that one. I hope.
She'll even, my dad will appreciate it. My mom will believe it. So it's great. Thanks.
My mom still says, Alex, you're in marketing. What the hell is that?
I totally get it. Yeah.
So that's a good start for the conversation. What the hell is marketing these days? Tell us, Mike.
So when I think of marketing, I reduce it to a statement of sales overnight, brand over time. And to me, that is understanding the consumer, the marketplace, and the company's position in a way that you drive sales and profits today and set up the company to do sales and profits tomorrow. And everything else to me is secondary to that kind of thinking. So that's how I almost always distill it whenever I go in and whenever I train any of my folks. That's kind of what we look at. And all the other measures, they're really great and they help, but they're diagnostics. Because if you don't sell stuff and make money over time, that's why the company hired you and that's why they give you money.
I love it. I love the definition. Let's talk a little bit about the F word these days, right? Fractional chief marketing officer. What do you make of this? All of a sudden, everybody's moving towards fractional. And is this the sign of the times? Is this something that artificial intelligence is responsible for, or any other innovation? Or is this something that companies are pursuing because of cost reduction? Why do you think this phenomenon is taking place right now?
I don't think there's one reason for it, but I think it's a pretty smart move for a lot of companies. Two, it makes sense in today's marketplace. And I'll tell you why. I think there's a couple factors that make fractional work, not just for a CMO, but for a lot of C-level jobs. I think it makes an awful lot of sense for a couple reasons. One, there's so much technology out there, you can't manage everything. So you may be, particularly an early stage or mid-stage company, you may not need a super CMO or someone. You may need to rent someone that can actually build you traffic and audience if you're a startup. Because that's all you should probably care about as a startup and a good position. You may be later where you want to build a brand, but then you want to evolve kind of that leadership role. And so I think there's renting the skill that you need when you need it. Because once you make a hire, you've basically boxed in your skill set. And renting that skill from a skill set perspective and a vendor management perspective and everything else, I think that makes a lot of sense. And then there's an awful lot of folks that are available who have either a lot of experience and a lot of wisdom or both that they may not want to take a full-time job and you only need 2 or 3 days or you only need a temporary person. That's, this to me is the marketplace evolving logically. I don't even think about it as the F word. I think about it as a natural evolution of there's so many stages of a company and the company needs different things at different stages. And that includes the marketer. And so, look, in general, I do think you need a CMO or a customer kind of champion. But in some places, you don't need that full-time. And surely in the smaller companies, you don't need it full-time.
But why now? Why is it that we don't hear a fractional chief financial officer?
Oh, there are. There's a lot of CFO fractional.
There are? Okay.
I was in the Valley for a long time, and there's tons of fractional CFOs. They'll give you 2 days and you know, close the books because you're a small enough company, you don't need someone 5 days a week, especially if you're a small company. I think what in the marketing world, it's later, and I do think it's a little harder to be a fractional CMO because a lot of the job is less clear. In finance, you have the stations of the cross, you know, you gotta do FP&A and you gotta do, you know, you gotta run all the cash and payments and everything else. And close the books, but in marketing, you may have totally different needs at your early stage, like round A, B, or C, and then as you get to be a bigger company, you may need different players. So the other thing that's good is now the technology. I mean, we're obviously doing this remotely. You don't have to be there sometimes any of the time. But certainly not all the time, meaning you can go get a skill and it's way easier to rent it. No, I'm all for in-person as much as you can. I love remote and I think it's great, but I think in-person generates way more ideas, relationships, and training.
Well, I mean, companies always relied on chief marketing officers and marketing organizations to drive innovations, to drive something new, being the voice of the customer, being the customer's shepherds and so forth. Can fractional resources drive innovation inside of an organization? Is this possible, being a fractional resource and, you know, be at the helm of the innovation strategy within a company?
I think it's harder, but it's surely not impossible. I think it really depends on the company and the leadership. I mean, I've seen innovation be driven, but from any level and anywhere in the company. It really depends on, is the company really good at it and does it really want to innovate? A lot of companies, there's no company that says they're not innovative, but a huge amount of companies are not. They don't want to innovate unless they know it's going to work, which by definition is not an innovation. And whether you're a fraction or a full-time CMO or see anything there, if the company doesn't really believe it, it's not going to innovate very well. Even though it's going to demand innovation, it's going to say, we're like little entrepreneurs inside this company. We have an entrepreneurial spirit. They don't really have it. And they want to be sure the innovation is paying out before it's tried, which is kind of a doom loop. So why a lot of innovation never gets off the table in my mind.
Interesting. Now, you spend a lot of time with some of the startups as well in early stage companies. As an advisor, almost as a fractional chief marketing officer or chief innovation officer. Yeah. How is that experience different from large organizations, large enterprises?
Again, I think it really depends on the startup. And I think if the startup really, and I did a startup for a year as well, as the head of marketing and consumer. But I think if the startup is really ready to listen and there's a good match in what the skill set is and what the company needs, you can really help those companies just by asking a lot of good questions. You can do that from a board seat too. If the company really doesn't want to hear new ideas, you can be an advisor or a board member or anything and it's not going to work. And I have a little thing where I talk about, if you're Ben Franklin and you come into a meeting and you say, I'm going to fly a kite and see if there's electricity, you know the company is against you when they say, do you know how much kites cost? How are you going to pay out that kite? And then you say, it's like $5. I'm going to try it. And then they say, well, if you find electricity, what are you going to do? And you say, I am just trying to fly the kite and see if there is electricity. And then they make you do an entire plan for if there's electricity, how much will we sell in 20 years and how will you store it? How will you build the Hoover Dam? And as a result, that idea never gets out. If you know, the good company will say, look, and the good CMO or whoever will say, here's a little pile of money. Innovate with it and figure out something that we can put in next year's plan. Don't frivolously waste it on stupid stuff, but go do real innovation testing, and then we'll have something next year. And that's the brand over time part of sales overnight, brand over time.
You know, we talk a lot about innovation, and yet some folks, myself included, we're still having difficulties visualizing what innovation is taking place inside of a larger organization. So can you sort of dispel the myth or demystify this for us in terms of, okay, you're inside of a large organization, large enterprise company. What does innovation mean inside of a large company? How does the process of innovation take place? And practically, how is it being used?
Well, that is such a good question. And I think it's all contextual. I'll tell you, my view of innovation is there's innovation of stuff that's new to the company and innovation of stuff that's new to the marketplace. So, and your job is to get as much innovation as makes sense for the company through it. And I think certain companies are better at it. And almost always there's a couple of things that go with good innovation in my mind, which is it's innovation with direction. It's not just innovation for innovation's sake. It wants to achieve something in the marketplace or with the customer base versus just go invent something brand new. Two, responsibility is pushed down and people can actually go try things. And if they fail, they're not shot. No company says they shoot the people that fail innovation. But in essence, a lot of companies do. They may not fire that person or push them out. What they do is they marginalize them. And people notice that. And as a result, you don't get people flocking to the innovation. So those are the three things I look for. And then I think there's been, I had a personal lesson. I innovated when I was at Progressive a very long time ago. After I left Procter, I went to Progressive because I wanted a P&L. And I innovated this new product that was new for the industry, new for the company, and it didn't sell any policies. I mean, it sold no policies. I was on the cover of the company magazine at the time, and this is long, long ago when Progressive was a lot smaller, saying this was a great innovation. We didn't sell a single thing. And I shut this down. And what I learned from that is the company never punished me for it. They actually took the learnings from the innovation, applied it across the business, and that was great. Or at Best Buy, when they, at the time, you know, Best Buy sold a ton of music, and we innovated a huge amount around music in partnership with the music merchants and the retail folks. That was new to industry, new to marketplace, and the company gave you a lot of authority to go do that. If you don't have that much authority and you're running through a gazillion starting gates and you have to meet all these gates, back to Ben Franklin's thing, you're never gonna get electricity into the company. I think when you get to startups, it so much depends on the CEO and the lead team on how they think about innovation, and are they wed to their idea so much that you can't move it. So back to my point, there's innovation inside the company that you might just be borrowing stuff from other industries or even other companies in your industry that the company hasn't done. Still an innovation for you. And then there's true innovation, which is innovation for the marketplace, which hasn't been done.
Mike, let's switch gears for a moment. You meet Mike Linton of 25 years ago, and you sit across the table from him.
A lot more hair.
Well, look at me. What do you tell him? What is the advice you want to give him? What is it? What else do you want to tell him?
I think there's a couple pieces of advice I would have given myself 25 years ago. And I actually, you know, it's almost all learned the hard way, which is you only have to win about 20% of the arguments. The other 80 don't matter. And you should when you're going to lose gracefully. Two, when you're arguing a really hot point, recognize the other side could be right. And so argue your point, but don't argue it in a way the other side is bloody and smashed if you win. Try and have the argument as peacefully as possible. And I guess the third thing is you have to have decision rights in your job where you are in control of your money and your outputs, particularly as a marketer, or people will tell you the marketing they want you to do, and then they'll fire you when it doesn't work. And it's your job. The last piece of advice, and I actually started practicing this after my first head of marketing job, which is, if I'm going to get fired, I'm going to get fired on decisions I make, not on things you make me do. And so I am only taking the job if I have a lot of control over where the money goes, the decisions we make, and the stuff we put in front of consumers, or else you're making me a major league manager and telling me who to play and what plays to run and everything else. And then I'm still responsible for the score. I want that responsibility, and I interview actually for it.
Love
and I
that.
Try and operate. I try and operate as a board member too, which is I don't want to make any decisions for you. I want to ask you questions to help you make the right decision. But I don't want to tell you what to do as an operator. And my job is to make you think as hard as possible, so any mistakes are made in the boardroom, not the marketplace. But yeah, I go back to that. It's your responsibility to run the show. And I always want that responsibility when I'm in job.
I love that piece of advice. It's almost a quote. If you're going to get fired on the decisions you make, not somebody else. That's yeah. Great. Now, your career is extremely diverse. You came out of being a chief marketing officer and jumped right into the board seats. And a chief revenue officer position, which is almost a cross between operations and finance and, you know, and the sales and marketing and so forth. How is it different? How is it different for you to go from a marketing position, performance marketing position, to a board seat, which is very different when you think about it, and also then go to the other side of the enterprise, which is, okay, marketing, you've been spending the dollar. Now I want to see what the ROI is for that dollar, and let me account for that as well.
So there's a lot of questions in there, and I'll try and get to them in the right way. The first I will say is I was super helpful. I always had board seats while I was an operator, starting, gosh, like 20 years, and I'm always interested in board work. I think it makes you broader and bigger, and you see different problems. And it helps you be a better marketer or salesperson or GM. I think they're very different, which is if I am running the show, if I'm the CMO or the CRO, or my job is to deliver the financials today and set up to deliver the financials tomorrow. And my whole team is going to pay off of sales and profit first. And we'll try and get even our agencies on that kind of rhythm, particularly on sales, because that's what we care about the most in the financial space. When you're on the board, you're not operating. And I never want to operate if I'm a board member, unless the board specifically says, come in and help us with this, and management is okay. Because I know how much I hated people telling me what to do when I am an operator. And so I think when you're on the board, your job is to help the operators think differently, get bigger, represent the marketplace and the consumer in the way the company's not thinking about it, and ensure that you make the mistake in the boardroom, not the marketplace. But you're not the operator. You are the coach. And you do have responsibilities in public boards, obviously, to shareholders, and in private equity boards to the owners. I'm always working for whoever my investor is when I'm on the board. But your job is not to manage, it's to help management. But that means you have to be prepared and you have to ask really good questions and make people think versus make statements about how you did it at such and such a company or whatever else. Yeah, it'd be great if we could all have a, you know, brands like Tide or something. But, you know, that those are, you know, you can't just assert that we should do this. You have to ask questions to get the most out of the company where it is. And then in PE, you might have private equity. You might have different time horizons you're helping the PE firm manage to. That's probably too much of an answer.
No, it's a great answer. Speaking of private equity firms, obviously it's a phenomenon that's been with us for a long time now. PE firm is acquiring a company, maybe even consolidating a number of different companies in the same category. What is your behavior inside of an organization now that it's owned by a private equity firm? And you now have to face one of the managing partners or general partners or something like that, asking tough questions.
A couple things. One, we did a whole show on this in CMO Confidential called What Private Equity Really Thinks About Marketing. But look, I always want the hardest questions I could get because the marketplace is going to ask them one way or the other. And I would much rather have them ask during the development of the project or the idea phase than have the marketplace eat me alive because I didn't want a hard question. So I want the hardest marketplace questions I can get. And I think PE brings, if you can't do math and you can't do financial, PE is going to be really hard on you. But my thing, and fortunately my team went on to be CMOs, is we're going to all be able to talk financial. And because the universal language of the company is, at all companies, is financial. That's the one language everybody gets. And PE gets that as well as anybody. I think one of the keys to private equity is understand the investment thesis and understand with your job, if PE owns your company, how you are playing into the investment thesis. Yeah, I learned this the hard way in my early jobs. I was thinking of something for 10 years. They wanted to sell the company in 3 years. That's a mismatch in how you invest. And they're not against that investment, but if it can't show some kind of results that jacks up the price earnings multiple, they're probably not going to be that excited about it. And you should have the foresight to see why they invested in you and what they want you to do as part of that thesis.
Great advice. I want to talk a little bit about the topic that I often talk about, which is an intergenerational, multi-generational interactions inside of an organization. Being under the same roof with some of the more experienced or older generation professionals and executives, and also some of the younger ones. What do you think is going to be the right formula for an organization? Should there be a mandate to mix and match? Should there be a mandate to fuse, if you will, the experience with innovation? Only because sometimes innovation is being synonymous with the younger, more dynamic, more entrepreneurial, you know, and so forth. What do you think the formula is?
I tend not to like formulas, particularly for stuff like this. I like, what does the company really need to succeed? And what I think is really tough, particularly in marketing, is marketing to me is where technology, the consumer, and the company meet. So you're almost always on the front end of where your consumers are consuming whatever new technology there is. And you have to understand how your product and communications and your marketing are interacting with the consumers through almost always that new technology in addition to the old technologies. And you can go way back. I mean, way, way back with when TV and radio start, that changes everything. And then you get cable, and then you get kind of the beginning of data where you can start parsing out delivery and mail and everything else. And then things explode faster and faster. You get mobile, you get the internet, you get big data, AI, at speed. All those are exponential complications for the marketer and the company. The company needs to get that right, and it needs to have enough people playing that it stays on the front end of that movement where tech and the consumer are meeting, but not so much that it loses where it is. And you're seeing the streaming companies now, or the entertainment companies, I should say, really struggling with the, how do we move to this new technology given how much money we make off the old technology? In a way, we still make money and our investors are happy, and that is hard. I think you need a blend there of experience and new pushers, new people that have grown up with the new technology, but you can't lose your balance. So I guess my answer to this question is, my goal has always been, whether I've been on the board or in the C-suite as one of the C-suite leaders, I want the right balance between pushing for innovation and making money with what we know today and ensuring we have enough money that we are testing enough new stuff so we are not caught dead 2 years from now with no practice in the new technology.
You often talk about some of the controversies and edgy topics in marketing metrics and performance and so forth, and what is happening right now with the Googles and Facebooks and Instagrams of the world and so forth. That's probably a topic for another conversation. We'd love to invite you for another talk. But let's close this one with your podcast.
Okay.
Tell us more about what CMO Confidential is, and why does it have to be confidential? What's all that about?
I would love to talk about the big data, about the data stuff, because I love the data, but I think you can't just rely on the data as a leader. It's helpful, but if you are stuck in the math, you stop thinking about the future. You start thinking too much about efficiency. So the back to the podcast, CMO Confidential. My thing is, if I go back to my 25-year-old self, there's a whole bunch of stuff when you're in marketing in particular, you want to talk about in the open, but no one really talks about. So that's, the show is designed to not talk, I'm not talking about how to do, better search word buying or CAC or brand briefs or anything else. You can learn that. I'm talking about how to do the job. And how you should get the right job for you and how you should manage things like socio-political stance or IT or private equity or venture capital and like things, how to get the most out of your agency for real. And it's designed to be a 360-degree look at the job where you talk to all the functions and types of people that interface with the job. And I did it because I thought, in my mind, marketing, particularly the CMO job, is the least consistent, probably the most misunderstood job with the most different expectations and one of the least well-managed functions in the C-suite by far. And I did this, I did it for kicks, and now we've got over 50 shows, I guess. It's been a lot of fun, but I did it for kicks, and I'm still kind of doing it for kicks. So
we'll definitely look for
one other thing I will say about it. It forces you to learn a whole new thing about how the infrastructure beneath all of this works and what's it really worth and how does it actually operate. And that has been a riot to learn a whole new thing.
That's amazing. We'll definitely look forward to a number of episodes on the CMO Confidential. Mike, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Always a pleasure to follow you. Always a pleasure to learn something new from you. And we'd love to have you again on our show. And I appreciate you being with us today.
It was my pleasure. I'd love to come back. And I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you.